Good evening. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sponsorship, I have found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering chemical since January 5th of 1971, and for that I'm extremely grateful. You know, I've really been impressed since I got here. I know a lot of people, Cersei tend to run things, I understand, and in a very good fashion, I might add, but a lot of people just picked this up and ran with it, but I'm amazed at how complete they've made everything. They even got air freshener if my talk stinks afterwards. I've never seen that before, but that's a nice touch. I kind of like that. And I want to thank Smitty for asking me to come and talk here tonight. I remember when he called me, he emailed me, I think. And he said, would you be available May 27th? And it's funny because I'm blessed to be a lot of places, and that weekend was wide open. So I was really excited about coming and spending the weekend here and with Smitty and Mona, and still am. Because Smitty was about living, and Smitty was about going on, and Smitty was about carrying on. And from what I've come to learn about Cersei, that's what Cersei was about, too. It was about staying sober, and it was about getting on with the business of living. And let's say goodbye, but let's not say so long, and let's keep living one day at a time. And so I'm delighted to be here. Some of you have heard me talk before, some of you haven't. I'm delighted always to meet new people. Cersei, I hear, just remembered everybody, and I forget everybody. So I remember one time I told my sponsor, I said, you know, I have trouble with names. He said, you don't have trouble with names. You just don't give a crap. I thought, well, that was kind of rude, you know. He said, you know, if they owed you $100, you'd remember their name. Well, he had me there, I'll tell you. So if you borrow $100 from me, I'll probably remember you. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love God, and I love being sober, and I don't apologize for any of that anymore. I don't even call God higher power. I give him top billing now. For a long time, I didn't. And, each their own. But I realized for me, I was just making my God second class to conform to what you might think. And what you might think about my God isn't important. What I think about my God is important. And you've taught me that here. I come from a very elite group of people called white trash. And it wasn't easy to maintain our reputation, but by God, we did. You know, it took a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of jail time and cars parked in the yard, but we did pretty good at it. And I was the youngest of seven children. I was the baby. And my earliest memories in life is I didn't like what I saw. I didn't like my family, and I didn't like where I lived, and I automatically knew all that was wrong and I shouldn't feel that way. It's just my story. That's the way it was. Didn't like anything about it. I don't know when I took my first drink because my mom and my dad thought it was funny to get me drunk as a kid. And all us kids did. We'd drink beer and we'd stagger around and it was funny. But I know this, that real early in life, I preferred alcohol. Thank you very much. I preferred alcohol that went into my heart and instead of what was going into my heart and my mind. And was that abuse? No, I don't think so, because I'll tell you what, if I didn't drink, I probably would have died by my own hand. Because I did something, I don't know if you do it or not, but I know I did it, and I did it a long time sober. And I call it my 299-to-1 theory. I could walk into a room of 300 people, 299 could turn around to me and say, Ed, you're the best. We love you. And one could go, jerk. And guess who got my full attention? Now, here's the sick part about that. Real early in life, the 299 didn't even exist anymore. Just the ones. The one teacher that slapped me when I was new in school. I used it in church. I remember my mother used to drag us brats, children, to church. And, you know, you got to watch ministers. They all got thin blue lips and talk like this, you know. Somebody else mentioned that shaking finger and pointing at me. And he'd always look at me and say, you're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do. You're going to burn in hell. And I thought, how do you know? I've only been here a half hour. But I remember there was this one guy sitting up front in the church, and he was in the front pew, and he looked holier than thou, had thin blue lips. I thought, you know, you looked a lot happier in the bar last night. And I don't know who that old sourpuss is with you, but the one you had last night seemed to be more fun, too. Now, I'll tell you what's wrong with that. I judged that entire church by that one guy. In fact, I'll tell you how dumb I am. I judged entire organized religion by my one. And I wondered why I had to drink. You know, if you're like me and you start collecting those ones and you put them in that bag about school, about your life, about the way you live, about your parents, about that bag gets heavy quick. And there's only one thing that'll lighten that load if you're like me. And that's a little drinky poo. Just a little something to take the edge off. Clancy always says it went boom. And I don't know that it ever went boom for me, but I'll tell you what it did do. It made it so it didn't matter so much. It made it so I didn't care what you thought anymore. And I started lying at a very early age, and it took me a long time sober to quit telling this lie. And the lie was simply, I don't care. You keep drinking like that, you're going to die. I don't care. You keep it up, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. I don't care. And I got to believe in it. At the ripe old age of 13, I was arrested by the Iowa Highway Patrol for possession of a sawed-off shotgun. I had a double-barrel 12-gauge that was 14 inches long, and I learned when you pulled that out and you ripped it one or two, they seemed to depart quickly. And I kind of like that, because if there was anybody going to hurt, it was going to be me for a while, because already at that age, my heart had been broken too many times. And I remember the patrolman, I didn't know much about guns then, don't know a lot about it now, I just knew when you whipped that baby out, people moved. And the highway patrolman said, what are you doing with this? And I know nothing about hunting, and I said, well, I go rabbit hunting with it. The officer said, what do? Run them down and beat them to death with it? I had no idea about range and scatter and all that. But, God, I can remember going to jail that night. And, man, I was tough. I was tough. I remember I beat up the guy next to the cell with the light on. Because I'm not going to sleep without a light on. And you ain't ever going to know that. You'll just get out of the cell or I'll kill you. And as everybody goes to sleep, those tears just stream down my face, thinking, what's wrong with me? This was never my plan. When they'd say that to me when I was a kid, that I was going to end up, I said, no, I won't. Here I am. And that really explains my drinking history. I can remember one of the last times I was thrown in jail, I got thrown in there, and I don't know, it was assault and battery, assault with intent. I like to beat up people. And well, it was a way of feeling worthy. It was a way of being somebody. It was a way of keeping you away from me. And I remember I was in jail, and I did some serious thinking about my drinking. And I thought, you know, when I get out this time, I'm going to get a job. No, seriously, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to support that child I have, and I'm not going to lay a hand on that girl anymore, you know. I always said I'd never hit my wife. Boy, you drink a lot over that when you do that after you swear you wouldn't, and then you look at those hands afterwards and you're just disgusted. And the only thing you can do is drink and lie to your friends. Anybody hits a woman's got to deal with me. I remember sitting in there thinking, I'll never do that again. I'm going to make Mom and Dad proud of me. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do something. And you know, whatever the sentence was, eventually they'd kick me out at 5 a.m. and I'd hit those streets and I'd be ready to get a new life. And about noon, that hole in my gut with the wind blowing through would just kind of open up. And I'd ache and I'd be lonely and I'd want somebody to talk to. So I went by the biker bar where all my friends were. And Manny Corello, he was president of the Grim Reaper at that time, counseled with me briefly. I had a few drinks, and the day seemed to slip away, and the next thing I knew, I woke up in jail, and I said, next time when I get out, and if I did that once, I did it dozens of times. Same thing. Every time I said I wouldn't drink anymore, by God, I meant it. I meant it with every fiber of my being. I knew about A&A. My brother, when I was 10 years old, brought me to A&A. He's sober 44 years. You know, he's so dry, we don't let people smoke around him. We got a few hot fire hazards around here today, too, you know. But I love that. I love the old-timers in AA. But, I mean, he just took me to A&A, and I thought it was real cute. There was some old guy up here about 30, you know, and his name was Fred. And he said, "My name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic, and I thought, good for you, Fred." God. I thought, if I ever get old and burn out, I may be here, too, you know. I didn't know I was a prophet at that point. The reason I share that story with you is it registered nothing with me. For the next 10 years when I was out there running around and going to jail and breaking hearts, especially mine, and all the others around me, and making those promises that I met when I made them, and then looking at that disappointment. And if you look at that disappointment, you see that look, you know there's only one thing to do. You got to drink to hide that. You got to drink to hide that. And they lied to me when I came to AA. They really did. I hear a lot of people, "I've never been lied to when I came to A&A. I was. They said, "If you keep drinking and using, you're going to die." And I thought, when? When? Don't lie to me. Man, to die would be the biggest break I ever had. Because when I'm sober, it gets scary. My guts tighten up. There are 10,000 voices in my head. And they keep telling me drinking's my problem. And I think, man, if I stop, you're dead. You're just gone. To this day, I've never told anybody I made a 12-step call on. You know, if you keep drinking, you're going to die. I think, you know, you keep drinking, it's probably going to get worse, and you're going to live a long, long time. That wakes them right up, I'll tell you. January 5th of 1971, I got sober. I really didn't mean to. It was kind of an accident, literally. And I was in a car wreck like I'd been in a car wreck many times. I'd been hanging around A&A for a while. And a buddy of mine knocked on the door, and he was out driving, and we got in a car wreck. And it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's 18 below zero, and I'm laying in the middle of the street pretending like I'm knocked out. I'm not sure why, but it seemed like the thing to do at the time. And the police came up, and now I'm a cop fighter. Are there any other cop fighters here? Okay, I just like to share something with you that I never knew. There's always more of them. Missed that one completely. And I mean, I had me programmed that if I saw a crossing guard, if I saw a badge, I'd swing at you. And these cops come up, and they saw me laying there, and they said, "That's Mutum, don't touch him, he's the scum of the earth. Car's probably hot. Don't even cover the SOB. And an amazing thing happened. I agreed. 20 years old, laying in the middle of the street. I was done. All of a sudden, it had nothing to do with how I was raised or where I was raised or what my mother did or didn't do, or what my father did or didn't do, or the opportunities I did or didn't have. It had to do with the way I looked at life. And the way I processed life and the way I lived life, the only common denominator in all my troubles was me. And it was crystal clear that night. And they took me into the hospital and they rolled me past this nurse. And the nurse said, "Ed, do you want me to call AA? And I went, "Might as well." Now, those of us who have been around a while want to know why you newcomers can't be sincere like we were in the old days, you know. I used to say that. God. And thank God a guy come up. And I was drinking the good stuff then. It's Ariba wine. I don't know if they have it down here. It was, at that time, it was 39 cents a quart. And I don't know that it ever ran into a grape. But I had to hold my nose to drink it. Otherwise, I'd lose it, you know. So. But it was good stuff. The only thing about that, the next morning you got those dry heaves and the headache going in, and I had a brain concussion on top of that, and a guy comes in named Hap, short for happy, to make a 12-step call on me. And he comes in and says, "Hi, my name's Hap, and I'm an alcoholic," and I thought, get out of my room. Who needs smiling? There ain't nothing to smile about. And he said, "We don't drink and we don't use, one day at a time." And I don't know why I got honest. I just did. And I said, "You don't seem to get it. I can't make it a day without something." And I'm one of those that had every problem you could have and tried everything. I never once said, oh, before I take these, what effects will they have? Oh, really? Oh, never mind then. No, I wasn't. Any more? And I learned real quickly that little twinge hurts for a second, but when you let it go, it's where I drank to always get. And I've never had to go to any other program for any of those because I believe being an alcoholic encapsulates everything I need to know. For me, anything that's mood-altering is absolutely a no-no for me, unless I have some deep physical problems. Notice I didn't say emotional. But I could start a whole new business there. Anyway, Hap was nice to me, and I started going to meetings, and I remember going to meetings, and are there any good shakers here? No shakers? See, too much medication out there. Need good shakers. In the old days, man, we used to have good shakers, didn't we? Oh, God, yeah, you know, if you needed cake mix, just give it to them. They'd go, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I was that way. I was, how are you? Ed? All good. You, yeah. Nice to see you. You want to cut the cake? No, thanks. You know? And it was just bad. My arms would go. You know? And I'd be sitting there trying to keep it cool. You know, it's tough to look cool when you're bouncing like that. And I had two rules. One of the rules was don't come up behind me. The other rule was don't touch me. Two simple little rules, and I had a little guy named Harry who didn't know about the rules, I guess. And Harry was the coffee pourer in my home group at that time. And Harry'd come up behind me, and he'd put his hand right here on my shoulder, and he'd pour the coffee. And for some reason, it was the first time I'd ever experienced peace, and I didn't know why. But the voices stopped, the war stopped, and I could breathe deeply. And he poured that coffee. And I swore he'd pour it slow, and I loved it. And then he'd quit, and the voices would start, and the noise, and I'd drink that coffee just as quick as I could. How can a big, tough guy like me say to Harry, little Harry, thanks for loving me, man. Thanks for touching me. Thanks for validating my existence by a little touch. Thank you. What we say to people really does count. You know, there's a lot of sarcasm and crap going around, and I say crap because I was an expert at it for a lot of years, and it just isn't necessary. If you take sarcasm and reduce it to its Greek word, I believe you'll find it says something like to the effect of ripping of flesh or tearing of flesh, and I was really good at that. I was really good at that. Thank God Harry wasn't. I remember one time there was a guy named Jimmy Ryan. He passed away. He was from Texas, in fact, Dallas, is now that I think about it. And Jimmy was a rapid-fire salesman. He lived in Malibu, and he rubbed his hands together like this, and he had his little twang. You know what I mean. And he'd say, you know, son, I asked some psychologist why I rubbed my hands together like this. He told me, he said, I smacked him right in the mouth, you know. And Jimmy was great. And I'm one of those people that had deep, dark depression sober. I haven't had any for a number of years, and I only use the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that annoys a lot of people. Pray for me. And I don't care to hear your story. Thank you very much. No. You've got somebody to talk to, I'm sure. And I'm not trying to be rude. It's just I buried a lot of my friends that listened to that song, and I'm tired. I'm tired of burying my friends that people saying, oh, it's okay. They don't know what they're talking about. The hell we don't. You know, the hell we don't. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get on that. But I remember sitting in that meeting, Jimmy Ryan. I'd walk into this club, and I had this depression. I was in the darkest place. You know, when you're really in a dark place, you don't leave notes. If you're really serious about it, there's no notes. You want to check out is what you want to do. And I was going to go to my sponsor's house and go into the garage and turn on the gas and just lay down and go to sleep is what I was going to do. And I stopped by the club on the way home, and there's Jimmy Ryan. And I walked in, and for some reason, if he did it once, he did it 10 times. And I don't know if he said this to everybody, but it really doesn't matter. I walked in, and I said, Jimmy, how are you? And it was like the world stopped. And I swear he took my face like this. I know he didn't. because I wouldn't have let him at that time. But it sure felt like he took my face like this and he'd say, I'm much better for seeing you, my friend. I am much better for seeing you. And Jimmy saved me that day. He didn't know my plan, but he knew about the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knew about taking a minute to lift up somebody rather than to tear them down, you know. And I'm so grateful for those lessons. I remember I was going to meetings a lot, and there was a minister in the group, and he had thin blue lips, talked like this. And I was about 6 months sober. That's where you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tack to go with it. I'd suggest you wait for the 8 months, but I was 6 months sober, and this minister said, Ed, why don't you come back to church? And I thought, I'll tell you why I don't go back to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. And I felt pretty good telling him, I don't mind. And he said, well, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. Made a point not to talk to him for the next few months, I'll tell you. When you're new, if they say something that really makes you mad, it's the truth. At least that was my experience, and even when you're used, it's the truth. And I can remember there was an old-timer named Logan in there, and we just buried Logan a year before last with 56 years of sobriety. And I was sitting in the club one day, and I had my feet up on the table, and they just gave me a key to the club. And Logan walked in and said, think you got all the answers, don't you, kid? And I said, no, but I was thinking, yep, pretty much got this wrapped up. And he said, let me tell you something. I was young once, but you've never been old. I was young once, but you've never been old. It is the first time in my life I've ever entertained the possibility that he may have felt the way I feel, that I'm not alone. Maybe he does know. And to the old-timers here, I was in Daytona last week, and Cliff R. and I were talking, and Cliff was the old-timer, and I'm just a year behind him. And I don't like that. And I just celebrate the old-timers here and the sobriety that's here, and my hats are off to you, and I mean that with everything in me. I thank you for clearing the way for people like me, chopping those weeds down and walking forward, and Searcy, who would open his heart and his mind to everybody, and guys like Bob, mountains of people, of individuals that would highlight what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And I thank you. If you haven't been thanked today, I want to thank you. Phil always talks about, have you been told you've been loved today? And I always like to ask an old-timer if you've been thanked today. Because without you, I am absolutely nothing. It would be just like being without my God. And I don't ever want to experience that. Yet I'm in the program that insists I rely upon God. I made a mistake my first year sober. I know you guys didn't, but I made one. And it was a biggie. I didn't mean to make it. I had a lot of problems with God. In fact, I hated him. Didn't like him at all. He was a punk. And just reporting, I'm not trying to be rude. I used to say I was agnostic or an atheist. I was not. Everything I knew about God, I absolutely hated. God was some punk who ripped people out of my life and would never show his face, because if he did, I'd teach him something. Oh, you laugh. You don't get it. You don't get it. Because it was flat the truth. I was angry. I was mad. And I was, oh, man. Because I had all my ones. Remember my 299 to ones? I had a whole bag of ones about God. I had a little cousin that, when I was 10 years old. If there's anybody ever close to somebody God-like, it's Linda. She was wonderful. Hated her. She was wonderful. She did everything right, and I hated her but admired her. I knew I could never be that good, but man, she was something. And she was walking across the street one day, and a truck came by and hit her and knocked her a couple hundred feet and killed her. And I went to the funeral home. You know what they said? God must have wanted an angel. And I thought, so he hit you with the truck. I'll pass. Got news for you. Still do. And years later, tragic things would happen. Oh, God must have had a plan. God must have done that. Who wants part of any God like that? I certainly don't and still don't. So imagine how upset I was when I learned that I had to have a belief in God. But then they give me the good news. It was a God I could make up. I was always a great dreamer. I really was. Probably would have done better in school if I wasn't like this. And so I thought, good, and I really went to work. I made up a God that was kind and loving and forgiving. Guess I showed them, huh? It's the opposite of anything I'd ever stored, I'll tell you. And I told those guys that, and they acted like it wasn't an original idea. You know, they didn't seem to mind that my God was going to be kind and loving at all. So I did that. But the mistake I made was I started professing a faith I didn't have. And I hear it all the time in AA. And usually the mistakes I see in AA is because I've made them very well. There's an old saying in AA, if you point your finger at somebody else, there's three pointing back at you. You ever heard that one? Did you ever hear that's for the good stuff too? Bet you hadn't heard that one. It is. If you see something that's good and glorious and wholesome and touches your heart, the only way you can recognize it is you possess it. It's for the good stuff, too. But I didn't have that lesson then. All I had was the bad. And I lost my place. So I got to start all over. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. But I started professing a faith in God I didn't have. I'd see old-timers in AA, and I'd look into their eyes, and they'd be talking about God, and I knew they were telling the truth, so I started parroting what they'd say. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. Easy does it, live and let live. And I meant that I wanted to mean it, God, they meant it, and sheesh, I just wanted to emulate them, and something bad happened. A little after I was a year sober, my dad called me up, and boy, when my old man called me up for dinner, you knew I was in trouble. And I'd been hanging around you folks in A&A, and you said I had to bring new attitudes into old situations. So I suited up, and I showed up, and I went to dinner, and about halfway through dinner, Dad said, boy, and I thought, oh, here it comes. I said, yeah, Pop. He said, I just want to tell you I'm proud of you. Now, I need to tell you something. Had I walked in there that night and you put a lie detector on my arm and asked me if I cared what that old man thought, I would have said no and would have said true. I am so grateful in Alcoholics Anonymous I found out I've been so terribly wrong about so terribly many things, and especially that one. That is something I could not dream in my wildest dreams, my dad ever saying to me. You see, I remember when I was 13 and I got kicked out of public schools and they wouldn't allow me back in. And the way he knew to beat was with fists. And he had me in the corner and he was punching away and he got done and I said, you through? And it's the first time I saw him cry. He had tears in his eyes, and he walked away. And I always thought, good, I got him. And that day it was clear that he'd done everything he knew to do for his baby boy, even what he didn't want to do. And it still didn't help. And I broke his heart. The only thing he ever wanted for his boy was to do better. And because of you, I was doing better. And it was one of the best nights of my life. And I went to a meeting, and after the meeting, I got a call from my mother, who was crying and hysterical, and she said, Ed, come home quick. Dad went across the street to get him a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop, and now they're carrying bodies out, and there's police everywhere. And I jumped in the car, and I ran across town, and I pulled up to that tavern where there were more police there than I'd ever seen in my life. It's funny how those cops had shaped up in that year I got sober. And in those days in AA, they used to release people to us all the time when they'd come in for drunk and disorderly, and we could just take them for 30 days. And if they got sober, everything would be dropped. If they didn't, then they went to jail. But we had a wonderful rapport, so the cops knew me because I was down in court almost every day trying to help anybody that could because of the help I'd been given. So when I walked in there, instead of an animosity, there was curiosity. One of the officers said, Ed, what are you doing here? And I said, my dad was in here. He said, oh, God, Ed. And I said, why? What's going on? He said, all we know, Ed, is somebody came in and opened fire and shot everybody. And I looked down the bar and I saw that pool of blood with my father's glasses all smashed up in it. And I got so sad. I just didn't want to know. And I'd always hoped and prayed you wouldn't know that kind of feeling. And then September 11th happened. and the bombing in Oklahoma City happened, and we all got to know that needless sense of homicide and heartbreak. And why? The officer said, Ed, we took all the bodies up to the hospital. Some are alive, some aren't. You need to go up there. And I went up to the hospital, and I walked in there, and there was an officer that hadn't forgotten my past. And he later died of Alzheimer's disease, and I prayed for him every day that he'd find some peace. But this day, he wasn't very kind. He hadn't forgotten my past, and he was kind of vulgar to me, and he said, what are you doing up here? And I said, I'm looking for my father. And he said, your old man ain't up here. I've identified everybody. Now get your butt out of here. Only he was a little more specific than that. He said, or we'll have you arrested. And an AA miracle happened. I said, okay. Why is that an AA miracle? A year and a half before that, they would have been looking for a new lieutenant. Nobody talks to me that way. Nobody. And I said, okay, and I left. And I went home, and I called the officer that had the last 5 years of my drinking and using, tried his best to put me away. He was head of the narco division. But the one thing I knew he knew is that I was sober. And I called him up, and I said, Bob, my dad was in that Shamrock Tavern. He said, oh, my God, Ed, hold on. And he fed me information, which he wasn't supposed to do. But he knew I needed to hear it. He knew I needed to have something going rather than my own head. And the only thing we could come up with is he had been shot and wandered outside, or they took him hostage. So we formed a search party, and for 8 hours we searched the streets, and 8 to 10 hours. And it was one of those nights of a quarter-inch ice on everything, and you couldn't stand up. And it was just, the only thing that would come to mind is the serenity prayer. And the only way it would come is one word at a time, because that's all I could handle. And I'd look under those parked cars, and I'd look in those garbage cans. You don't want it, but you got it. 8 o'clock the next morning, that officer from the hospital called me up and said, well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. You want to come up and identify your old man? And I jumped in the car, and I went up there, and I walked into the morgue, and I saw my dad with it, laying on that metal table with that bullet hole in his face. And there was some doctor explaining to me how the bullet exploded when it entered his head, and I told him I really didn't need that information. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing that year. And I came up with absolutely nothing. All I had was your words and none of my actions and none of my faith and none of my experience. Just a lot of words. And I hear people say a lot of times, you know, my best day, worst day sober isn't as good as my best, or however they say that. And that just isn't my experience. When I got sober, I've had a lot of horrible days, because before I would drink right through them. And the art of staying sober in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned, is to learn to live one day at a time without the use of alcohol and by the grace of God, regardless of the situation. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And I reached for that faith, and I had absolutely nothing, but I had AA. What I mean for that, I opened that door to the morgue, and right out there was a member of Al-Anon. And she just looked at me, and she gave me a little thumbs up. And everywhere I went, there was a member of AA or Al-Anon. Just coincidentally happened to be there. Everywhere. When I'd come out of my house in the morning, there'd be Big John going. She was just like God. Everywhere I am, he is. And all I need to do is say help, and it's there. But it was the example of faith. It was the example of Alcoholics Anonymous. Talk's cheap. Anybody can talk a good game. I've never been much of a guy for a big book quoter or Bible quoter. I usually say after the third or fourth quote, you know, you're so busy quoting, you can't be living it. Just my opinion. And these were people of action. These were people that were there, and they just loved me. They just loved me. And I don't know if you've ever lost anybody that you love through a needless homicide, but it's the most horrifying of emotions, and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy to this day, back then or even or especially now. But thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people around me who stood by me. And they didn't say, I know how you feel, because they certainly didn't. But they knew they were needed. And I remember going to the funeral, and there was a priest there that did the funeral, and he gave me a key to the kingdom. He said, halfway through the service, he said, you know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will. He said, I don't believe that for a minute. And I sat right up in the pew. He said, God created human beings, gave us a free will. Some of those human beings chose to do this act, and now it's God's will. And it was like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. You mean my cousin Linda got killed because of a human error? God didn't jerk her out of our life, make her an angel? That's right. You mean the reason kids are starving all over this world is because we're not feeding them? We're too damn greedy? Exactly. Don't blame God anymore. There's more than enough food. You mean the reason cancer's so rampant and it's killing all our loved ones and we want to blame everybody else and even God when we're polluting everything we touch? Don't blame God anymore. It's His world. He sees what we're doing to it. It makes Him sad. And it was one of the keys to the kingdom. I knew that God didn't take my dad or rip him out of my life. If anything, He welcomed my dad. It's just one word, but it's a major difference. Major difference. I had to go to the trial and testify against the guys. And I remember, oh, man, I just had a lot of ill feelings. And they ruined me in AA. They said, you got to go there. You might be the only example of the program they ever see. So they give me a suit that fit real nice. It was real good. And they said, you go in there and answer the questions and behave yourself. I've never done that in a courtroom in my life. But I tried to do the best of my ability what they told me to do, and I walked in there. And I remember sitting down and I'd seen this one guy sitting there, and I'd said, you punk, you give me 5 minutes in my head. You give me 5 minutes, we don't need a trial. In fact, bring all five of them in. We don't need a trial. But I behaved myself. I simply answered the questions and I left, and I was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous that day. And they convicted those people, and I was pleased. Shortly after that, God talked to me. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. Sponsors are excellent God filters. I remember one time I went to my sponsor and I said, God told me this. And I shared what God told me. He said, you know, Ed, this message from God looks strangely like your handwriting. Okay. But God told me to, I was sitting in my office one day. I was 22 years old. I was an executive director of an alcoholism and drug abuse foundation, youngest one in America at that time. And God talked to me. He said, Ed, go out to California. Get into show business. Packed up and left. 48 hours later, I was where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. Got a job at Disneyland. I was goofy. Boy, was I. Yeah. 2.5 years sober, no sponsor, not going to Betty Meetings. I was goofy. Yeah, I was goofy. And I never actually started that job up. I went up to West Los Angeles, and I went into a meeting, and there was enthusiasm, and there was life, and it was about living, and it was about staying sober, and it was about the enthusiasm of life. And I just loved it. So I went up the next week. And there was this guy there directing stuff, and I went up to him, and I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. I kind of knew the A&A rule, you know, if you AA request and all that. And he said, a few minutes later, he came up and said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. Ha, 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 ha. I thought, oh, good, tall jokes. That'll make me feel good. I got to tell you, there's a lot of people this weekend who asked me the same two questions. And it's always by the same size person. First question is, oh, how tall are you? 6'10". Oh, do you play basketball? No, how tall are you? 5'4". Do you play miniature golf? Seems fair to me. So he said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. Oh, and I thought, oh, cute. Yeah, that's what I need. And a few minutes later, it came up and he said, if you agree to do what I ask you to do, I'll be happy to be your sponsor. My name's Clancy. And I am forever grateful I didn't hear half the crap that goes around about him because you would have killed me. I would have listened to you. I would have believed you. And I would have died. I try my best not to put down any individual or group in Alcoholics Anonymous Who the hell do I think I am? I could be killing you. I might be cutting off the very lifeline you need to save your life. Let's get this ego and gossip and character assassination out of the way. The only way we can do it is to stop it when we're in the middle of it. Yeah. And please understand, Clancy doesn't need my defense, whether he's doing right or wrong. He doesn't need my defense at all. He just needs my love and respect because he saved my life. And I don't have time to do his inventory. I'm usually too involved with mine. He started me doing these steps, and Carol told you guys last night about me killing the goat. If you weren't here, I wrote my fourth step inventory. And it took me 4 days and four nights, and I wrote this inventory. And I went in to celebrate with Charlotte, Clancy's wife, that I finished this inventory. And at that time, they had a goat named Alfred. And Alfred snuck in the garage and ate the fourth step. And 2 days later, Alfred died. I guess it was my first sacrifice in some ways. Oh, well, that was theology a lot later. Anyway, he made me write that inventory. He made me do stuff I didn't like. At that time, the group was small. It was about 400. And he said, I want you to go in and say hi to everybody. I said, I don't like them people. He said, they don't like you either. Go say hi. So I went in and said, hi, I'm Ed. Hi, I'm Ed. Hey, I'm Ed. You know? Oddly enough, since then, I've traveled all over the world going, walking into rooms of strange people going, hi, I'm Ed. He taught me how to fit in. I'll tell you what sponsorship does for me, did for me, and does for me, is it taught me an easier way to do things than I'd ever figured. I remember one time I was in the garage. I was in the back bathroom, in the back of the house, and Clancy walked by and said, what are you doing, Ed? And I said, shaving. He said, well, wait a minute. And he came in, he said, turn on the hot water. I said, okay. He said, let it get nice and hot. He said, now soak your beard with that. Okay. It was a little hot, but I did it, you know. He said, now reach up there and get some of that shaving cream and put on there. Lather it up pretty good. I said, okay. And he said, now try shaving. Oh, I learned to shave in Scott County Jail when I was 13 years old. How do you shave? You pick up a razor and you shave. He didn't come up to me and go, you're an idiot. What's wrong with you? He has on other things, but not on that one. He showed me a better way. He showed me a better way. And that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I love about sponsorship. And that's what I love about, you know, talking about gratitude in action. God, I remember the time you get a sponsor, man, you can ask him those real difficult questions. I remember I went up one time, I said, Clancy, how do you be a gentleman? And he said, you act like one, Ed. God, I would have never thought of that. Just would have gone, you know. How do you be kind and loving? You act that way. There's another one. I would have never got that either. And it may sound silly to you, but it was the truth. He told me one time, he said, you don't get locked up for how you think, you get locked up for how you act. I don't care what you think, watch how you act. And I'll give you a little example of that. He pulled some strings and got me a job as a bellhop at a little hotel like this from 11 to 7 down on the ocean in Santa Monica. And they give me a little blue suit that fit real well, too. But this had a little blue hat to go with it. And I'd sit there and little old ladies would come in and drop their bag on my foot. Pick up that bag, boy. And I'd think, which one? You or it? I'm allowed to think that. What I did is say, yes, ma'am. And I'd go upstairs and I'd put the suitcase down and I'd open it up and I'd go to the door and wait for my tip. She slammed the door and liked to break my fingers. And I'm thinking, I'm going to kick in the door, grab this old broad, throw out the window and watch her splatter. But what I did is say, thank you. And I go downstairs. Doesn't sound like much, does it? It's called the third step. It's called freedom from the bondage of self. I didn't know that feelings were not facts. If I thought it, I thought I had to do it. I know that sounds crazy, but I didn't know. And my sponsor taught me that. Years later, Chuck C., who was just a wonderful man, I asked him, I said, Chuck, how do you pray? And he said, Eddie, your every thought's a prayer. And I went, uh-oh. did a little quick edit of what I'd been thinking. It was not good news, you know. But then another thought crossed my mind. If it's junk, why am I thinking it? If it's junk, why am I thinking it? Why don't I try to make my every thought a prayer? It became my goal back then. It is still my goal today. I'm better at it than I've ever been, but the journey continues. But 99.9% of the time, I like what I'm thinking. And I learned it right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. My every thought's a prayer. I remember I was broke, and I started all over with God. My first honest prayer I ever said is, God, I don't know if you're there or not. I sure hope so. I mean, if you haven't started with that prayer, I don't know what you can start with. At least that was for me. I had to put up all the stuff I'd been taught, had to throw out all my ones. And I started saying that prayer, and I was going to speak in Pasadena, California, and I was broke. I mean, I was broke. And I thought, ooh, Pasadena, wealthy area. I may hook up with a job. I may get, you know, and doing a little con in my head, and I caught myself right there. And I went into my bathroom, and I said the same prayer I said upstairs before I came down here tonight. I said, God, save me from my own nonsense. I used to use another word. I'd say, God, save me from my own nonsense, and let me share the miracle you've performed in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want a thing from any of these people. Nothing. And I went and I talked. And I talked at that meeting, and the guy came up to me afterwards and said, this makes no sense to me. Won't offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. He said, have you ever been in Taiwan? I said, no. He said, have you ever been in show business management? I said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. This was Saturday. Monday morning, I went in for an interview. Thursday, I was lifting out of LAX, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was new, soon to be vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 62 skaters that were coming over to Taipei, and I was going over to negotiate contracts with Taiwanese government, Department of Education, to provide them with an ice rink and skating rink and living arrangements while flying back and forth to Hong Kong with designer Bill Campbell to design their costumes. How was your week? I'll tell you why I share that with you. Somewhere along the lines, I dropped my bag of ones. There would have been a time when I wouldn't even showed up for the interview. People like me don't do things like that. I showed up for the interview. I remember getting off that plane in Taipei, and there's a Mercedes limo there, and a guy, I remember I got off the plane, everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them, you know? And I know it's just a matter of time before they tie me down. But I go up there, and there's a guy with my name badly misspelled, my limo driver, took me up to the President Hotel and walked me into the five-room suite that I had in the President Hotel that was just gorgeous. And I walked in, and the most amazing thing happened is I belonged there. I no longer had to argue with God and tell him I didn't deserve gifts he gave me anymore. You know, I travel a lot, and I hear a lot of people, and I'm sure it's well-intentioned, but they say things like, how are you? Oh, better than I deserve. And I keep thinking, so God's still wrong, huh? Toughest thing for me ever to learn to say is thank you. If you give me a compliment, thank you. I remember I was, right before I got this job, I was, Clancy walked up to me meeting, and I was broke, and he slipped me $5 in his hand when he shook my hand. And when he pulled away, I saw the $5. He said, oh, I can't take this. And Clancy, in his mild, loving way, said, shut up! Why don't you just shut up? He said more lovingly, why does it always have to be about you? Why do you have to destroy the spirit of the giver? You got no idea why I'm giving you that money. Why don't you just say, shut up? And shut up and say thank you. And I said, well, when you put it that way, I thank you. But it's the truth. It's the absolute truth. And I've been given many gifts, and the toughest thing for me to do a lot of times is simply say thank you. Thank you. That's all. No explanations. No destroying the spirit of the giver. I was with that job for about 6-8 months, and it was amazing. I had gifts that I never would have believed I had. And a guy walked by me one day. He said, you know, Ed, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I went, yeah, sure. And I went back to L.A., and 3 months later, the Harlem Globetrotters called me up and said, Mr. Mutum, we've heard wonderful things about you. Would you come in and talk to us? And I said, I'd be delighted to, because I don't have ones anymore. I'm opened up to whatever God wants me to do. I'm into walking forward rather than looking back. And I walked up there, and before you knew it, I was in New York City in Madison Square Gardens, and Meadowlark Lemon, Meadowlark Lemon and Curly Neal were on the bus, and I had every major credit card in the world and 10 grand cash. I thought, doesn't get better than this, I'll tell you. And I was wrong. That was good. But if you've had good days, the best is yet to come. I promise you. That was good. But it gets better. I remember when I was a kid, I used to dream about going all over the world meeting famous people, and I shared that with one of my playmates once, and he laughed at me. He said, people like you don't do things like that, Ed. Just, who do you think you are, man? People like us just go to prison and die. And I went, oh, and when I came into AA, you told me to recapture my dreams again. And that was when I recaptured to prove you wrong. I remembered it when I was in Madison Square Garden. And we were finishing up our national tour and just going on our European tour. And we were going to travel all over the world, first class, and meet famous people. You see, God in this program is about what I can't conceive. And the sooner I learn that, the better. See, what I can conceive on my own is usually of a negative nature. And what this program in God is about is all the goodness that I can't conceive. But if I walk forward, I can certainly experience it. And slowly conceive it. I got married to the daughter of the Turkish ambassador to London. She was Turkish, Muslim, and wealthy and beautiful. And I thought, well, our backgrounds are a lot alike. So, surely plain to you now that all my judgment hadn't returned. Oh, thank you very much. And funny, you all have white heads now. And I was married for 10 years. We have 3 children. And I would like to tell you that everything's wonderful, but I need to share with you that 2 of my 3 children hate every breath I take. And it's not as a result of anything I've done. It's a result of past experiences and a spouse that's unwilling to forget and forgive and to heal. And I'm sorry for her. I share that with you not to feel sorry for me, because I'm doing just fine because I give my kids to God. But I also share it to you because a lot of times we think everything's got to be in order before I can be happy, joyous, and free. That's crap. That's crap. I love my kids dearly. And I say 2 out of my 3 kids, because it was 3 kids till about 2 weeks ago. And I got an email from my oldest son. And we IM'd back and forth for about 30 minutes. And I don't expect to hear from him again. But if I do, I'll be glad. And we had a good conversation. You see, happiness doesn't have to be on my terms anymore. Every morning when I wake up, I thank God I don't have the compulsion to drink. I don't know why you're here, but that's why I came here. I do not have the compulsion to drink anymore, and if I forget that, then I might as well forget everything else. You see, I was one of those alcoholics for a long time that, well, I'm not drinking. What's next? You know, if I'm there, I'm in serious trouble. And I hear people all the time say, you know, it wasn't the burning bush deal, and I need a burning bush deal. And I thought, if you're alcoholic like me and you're sitting in this room sober, if that's not a burning bush, I don't know what to tell you. You know? I got divorced, and 18 years sober, I lost everything I owned. They got real personal. They even came and took the Mercedes. And I remember when I got my Mercedes, Clancy told me to go down and buy one of them import cars. So I came back with the Mercedes 450 SEL. I thought that was an import car. We could do that. And unbeknownst to me, what had happened, and I certainly didn't intend this, I promise you, is I became what I was rather than who I was. I became the former manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. I became a lot of other things. And I lost my identity in the world of sobriety. And if you do that, I need to tell you it's deadly. I think we lose a lot of people because God can be replaced so easily if we don't maintain it. At least that's my story. I went back to Iowa, Davenport, Iowa, And an old friend of mine that greeted me when I first come in, let me pry off some windows, boards off a boarded up window, and the city turned their head while I turned on the power. And I had a mattress in the corner of one room, and I had my big book, and I got this down on that big bed with that big book, and I opened it up, and I thought, what did I get wrong here? Because I've come to believe that that big book is the absolute truth. And if I'm not experiencing, it's not because the book's wrong. It's because I'm not doing something right. And the answer is right here. My old friend Chuck Chamberlain used to say to me, Eddie, what you came here looking for, you're looking with. What you came here looking for, you're looking with. Everything I ever wanted to be, I already am. And the 12 steps allows me to bring that out. Because I am basically good. I'm not basically bad. You taught me that here. You want me to prove to you right now that you're good people? It's real simple. I want you to take a minute. I want you to think of the worst thing you have ever done. Think about it. How does it make you feel? Good news, if it makes you feel bad, it proves you're good. Because if you were bad, you wouldn't care. Your very own proof that you're a good person. And God, I needed to know that. It wasn't I was bad trying to get good. You know, that I was good already and learned some bad actions. I started all over in, I remember I quit smoking. That was fun. You know, I was about 23 years sober and I went, possibly this isn't good for me. And so I quit smoking and I started running. The doctor told me to start running and exercising. So I started stretching and I got the right shoes and I went out and got a stress fracture all the way up my leg. Thanks, doc. When you're 300 pounds plus, don't jog. Just a thought. And I had my leg propped up, and God talked to me again. This time it was quite clear. I was kind of doing an inventory. It was 92. Things were getting back on their feet, and God talked to me. He said, Ed, what about education? And I did what any good alcoholic would do. I went, la, 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 la. Figured it'd go away sooner or later. It didn't. So I got my crutches and I hopped over to the university. And I went in there and I said, excuse me, I'd like to go to school. And they said, how many credits do you have? I said, I have bad credits. Why? What's that got to do with anything? And they laughed at me like you just did. And I was able to share with them a gift that I hope I never forget. I said, you don't understand. I don't know how to go to school. I don't know if I'm smart enough to pass a class. I got kicked out of school when I was in seventh grade. And I didn't pay attention years before that. But I know this, that I'd like to try. Would you help me? Never in my sobriety, when I sincerely asked for help, was I denied. Ever. And they smiled at me and they said, well, do what we can. 3 weeks later, I'm in the university studying with 16, 17-year-olds, and they're helping me with some things about life in these tests, and I'm helping them with some things about life in this test, and I just loved them. You see, what you've taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous is this is just the beginning of the 299. There's a whole world of 299s out there. Sometimes we get a little cocky and think we're the only ones in the world. I got news for you. The most of the world are wonderful, wonderful people. You see, I just got a jerk detector. And most days it's turned off anymore because I want to see the goodness. I want to see the God. I don't want to see the bad. And I started going to school, and I went on a Christian retreat, and I had a spiritual awakening on that retreat. I hadn't planned that either. And God just talked to me on a Saturday night and changed my life from that moment to this. Everything I had believed, I realized how wrong I had been. And how I'd underestimated the power of the loving God that I've come to know. And he said, I need you to go to work for me, Eddie. And I said, okay. And I left there and I had 60 hours of school in. And 3 weeks later, I'm a pastor. I'm doing services. And I'd never done it before, but I guess I can. Here I am. And I started studying and I went to seminary. And I had to finish my BA and then I had to get my little 96-hour master's degree, Master's of Divinity. And I did all that. And the only reason I share that with you is it wasn't about 96 hours. It was about what I needed to do to serve God as I understand him. And they needed me to do that. And it took 7 years. And I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. I did not miss one AA commitment. If it's all about me, I'm still got it wrong, in my opinion. You know, if it's still all about me, I've got it wrong. It's all about what I can do for you, what I can add to your life. And I became a minister, and I just absolutely loved that. I can remember the first guy that Harold was a wonderful farmer in the Midwest. He was just an honest, good, good man. If anybody had a problem, Harold would quietly take care of it, and nobody'd know. And they called me up one day and said, Ed, Harold wants to see you. He's dying. He just got back from the doctor, and they said he's got 3 months. He's got a radical stomach cancer. Will you come? And I said, sure. And I jumped in my car, and I went down there, and I went in, and I'm thinking, well, I probably should pray or something, but it didn't feel like praying. And I'm doing this on-the-job training stuff as a minister, but I went back to what I knew. I said, Harold, you want a cup of coffee? And he said, okay, Pastor Ed. We had a cup of coffee. We're talking, and I'm kind of searching, and Harold keeps looking out his bay window at his yard, and then I realized Harold had a huge farm yard, and he always kept it immaculate. And I looked out, and the grass was pretty long. And I said, Harold, would you mind if I mowed your lawn? And he looked at me and said, would you do that, Pastor Ed? He said, it'd be my privilege. And I went out and I mowed his lawn. It took me about 3.5 hours, and I did it every Monday for 3 months. And then one day I walked into Harold, and I said, Harold, I think it's time we pray. And he said, I do too, Pastor Ed. And we said a prayer, and it was a powerful prayer, and I ended it with, God bless you, Harold. And he said, no, 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 God bless you, Pastor Ed, because you see, Harold was a giver. And 2.5 hours later, he died. Best ministry I ever did. Where'd I learn that? By walking out of emergency rooms and morgues, and somebody was sitting there offering to help in any way they can. It's not what you say. Just a little nod or a wink or washing a dish or picking up some kids or whatever you can do. Just do it. And I'd never loved anybody like that before, outside of AA. And now I'm in love with the world for the most part. But it all begins with my members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in the Methodist Church for 8 years, and they came to me 2 years ago, and we had an agreement that one Sunday a month I could go talk in AA, and that was great for 8 years. Then we got in a new bishop, and the new bishop said, Ed, we need to talk. And I said, what's that? And he said, you either need to give up talking in AA or you need to give up being a minister in the Methodist Church. And I had a congregation of 1,200 people who were some of the kindest, most loving people I've ever met in my life. And I had walked with them in some of their most difficult times in life. When you're a pastor, you deal with death. You deal with a lot of terrible, terrible stuff that people go through every day. It's such an honor to do that. But it's so intimate and it's so close, and I had to tell them I was leaving. And they had a roast for me. And 450 people showed up for the roast, and nobody get up and roast me. One guy got up and said, we don't want to say anything bad about Pastor Ed, even in joking. All we did is come here to tell him that we love him, and we'll keep him in our prayers. And we know you believe in what you're doing, and we'll be praying for you. That's not a result of my seminary. That's a result of how you taught me to behave as a human being in Alcoholics Anonymous, to love unconditionally. I am not interested in what anybody thinks about me. I'm more interested in what I'm thinking about you. And it needs to be good. And my job is to love each and every one of you, and sometimes it takes a little time. It just does. I remember there was, you know, they always say, I'm going to love everybody. And I used to go, you know. And I can remember I was sitting in this meeting one time, and there was a guy there, and I thought, you know, 5 minutes in the alley with me, he'd find God. And that's the way it was. And I walked out and I got in the car and I thought, boy, Ed, you're supposed to love everybody and you're talking all this AA stuff. What's that about? And I realized if he had called me at 2:00 in the morning and said, Ed, I'm going to drink, I would have been there. You see, I loved him. I just didn't like him. But I can love everybody. And I want to help anybody I can in any way I can. And I don't want a damn thing from you. I don't do this because it's an insurance policy for me. I've been overpaid. I don't have to get one more blessing for as long as I'm alive. And I've been overpaid. What I would like is the opportunity, like you've given me tonight, to share the blessing with you. Of a God of my very own that I found in these rooms. Of a life and the person that I am today that I wouldn't trade with anybody. And I know some awful, wonderful people. I used to think, what did AA give me? And I finally figured it out. It's something I didn't know I couldn't identify, and one day I did. You've given me innocence. I'd never been innocent before. I was always guilty. You've restored my innocence. What else did you give me? I'm enough. I don't need something out here to complete me anymore. I need you, and I need God, but I don't need anything material. And if it gets down to push comes to shove, God will do it. And I'm not one of these guys, I don't want you to come up to me and say, you know, I found Jesus, I don't need A&A anymore. When people call me and tell me that and want to talk to me about that, I say, what meeting would you like to meet at? And we'll talk about that. I am real grateful for my faith, but it does not replace my Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you one other thing that annoys me to no end. I was talking in Virginia a while back, and there was a gal there, and her higher power was up and to the right. No. And I good for her. Up and to the right. And you know, it was okay that her higher power was up and to the right, but if I dared tell you that my higher power is Christ, I'd be asked to leave. What's that crap about? We're inclusive. We're not exclusive. I welcome you, and what he read at the beginning, whatever your faith is, I welcome you and I celebrate you. And I'll celebrate your faith with you. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Finding a faith of your very own. Yes, even if you're Christian, you can come in. About 4 years ago, I was preaching on forgiveness, and I was right in the middle of the sermon, and I realized I was being a hypocrite. And I stopped, and I said, I need to stop preaching on forgiveness right now. I realized that I haven't told the guys who killed my father that I forgave them. And I will not preach on forgiveness till I seek them out and I find them. 2.5 weeks later, as God would have it, one of the guys' sentence was overturned. And the press in my area, I'm well known and loved, thank God, in the way you've taught me to behave. They came to me because they said they were going to release him or retry him right now. And they came to me for my response, and I said, let him go. Let him start fresh. Let him start new. And the reporter said, Ed, he's been in jail since he's 17. It's 27 and a half years. He doesn't know how to work. How's he going to support himself? And I said, he can come live with me if he'd like. And people were taken back by that. And I'm not sure why. You welcomed me into these rooms. What is the difference? Given the right situation, I would have been where he was. Right situation, right amount of alcohol, right amount of chemicals, I would have been there. Who am I not to welcome him into my home? And you know that story went all around the world. Literally did. It was on the front page of the LA Times, the New York Times, the London Times, got calls from Oprah, 48 hours, 2020. And they kept saying, how could you do that? And how can you say, well, you know, it's step 8 and 9, Oprah. But, you know. And, of course, I didn't talk to her. I talked to one of her producers. No, I like her. She's a good gal. And people were overwhelmed by that. And I just meant it. And three weeks later, I was walking through a prison I swore I'd never walk through. I had a brother that got sober 6 months after I did. He was a three-time loser. He stayed sober 3 years, and I buried him at 36 years old because he decided he could drink again. And the last conversation he had with me, as he looked at me, he said, Ed, you're nothing but a loser, and you'll always be a loser. And at the funeral, I walked up to his casket, and I kissed his head, and I told him, I'm a winner, Charlie, and you could have been too. I was walking down that prison where he spent all that time, and as a kid, I had to go visit all the time, and I swore I'd never go again. And I walked into a prison cell, and I saw a guy I hadn't seen in 27 and a half years. Last time I saw him, I thought, you know, you give me 5 minutes with him, we don't need a trial. And I stuck out my hand, and I said, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that God loves you, and I love you. And he forgives you, and I forgive you. And if there's anything in my life I can ever do to make your life better, please allow me to do that. And I had a sense he looked in these old-timers' eyes, and he realized I was telling him the truth. There was no game here. And we talked for 2.5 hours, and the oddest thing happened. We became friends. And I was able to walk down. They decided to retry him. And in the state of Iowa, if you're convicted of murder, if you're just with them, you're guilty. And he was with them. And they were going to retry him. And I went down and asked my county attorney friend not to retry him, to give him a break and have some mercy. And he said, Ed, this guy's conning you. And I said, you don't even know I'm here. How's he conning me? And he listened to me. And a couple years later, I was allowed by the state of Iowa to go up to that prison and pick up my friend. I'm the only one they'd release him to because it was such a hot topic. And the press was going crazy because this never happened before. But that isn't what it was about. You know what it was about. Loving one another. That's what you taught me so well. To be of love and service, not to get into their inventory, to help them better whatever they're doing. And I remember going to the restaurant, and Sherman, I said, Sherman, now when you get in here, they're just going to ask you a lot of questions. They're not trying to hassle you. They're just going to ask you a lot of questions. How do you like your eggs? What do you into? One, wheat toast, white toast? You know? He said, really? I said, yeah, don't worry about it. He got done ordering and said, man, that was a lot of questions, wasn't it? And we were walking outside the restaurant, and there was a little pond off to the right, and he said, Reverend Mutum, do you mind if I stop a minute? I said, no, what do you want to do? He said, I just want to look at this pond. It had been 30 years since my friend was able to stop and look at something just because he wanted to. I had to keep reminding him it's okay for him to open the door now. Nobody's going to shoot him. I was able to take him to the mall and find out what size clothes he wore because all he knew was large, prison issue. What a gift I'd been given. Because you see, that hatred don't own me anymore. It doesn't own me anymore. Why? Because you taught me how to give it up. You taught me how to give it up, and you taught me how to live happy, joyous, and free. It says to me at the end of step 9, I will know serenity and I will comprehend the word peace. That has been true in my life. Every one of those promises has been true in my life. And it's not because I'm special. It's because this program's incredibly special and the God of my understanding is incredibly special. And it's not only for me. It's for anybody who wants it. Since I've been sober, my father was murdered. My mother died of cancer. Watched her. My sister-in-law committed suicide. Brother-in-law committed suicide. Another brother-in-law was killed in a truck wreck. Another brother-in-law put a gun to his head and was a vegetable for 2 years, lost everything I owned twice, been married and divorced. There is absolutely no reason you have to drink ever again if you don't want to. Because the answer's right here. I started a little church, and 2 years ago after I left the Methodist Church, and it's been a great time, and I had my last service a couple weeks ago. I'm moving down to Memphis, and I'm taking a new job, and I'm excited about that, but I'm just constantly amazed at the number of people who love me, and it just touches my heart deeply, and I had to say goodbye to them, and we had one last church service on a Wednesday night 2 weeks ago, and I wanted to share what the church had meant to them and the fellowship, and of course they made it about me, and that wasn't the point, but that's what they wanted to do. And my little friend Michelle, who is learning disabled, said the day Pastor Ed came to my graduation party and said the blessing was the best day of my life. And I wouldn't take $1 million for that. You see, you've taught me what life's about. And it's about the goodness. And it's everywhere we want to look. If we'll take time to look, the problem is not here. The problem is in my heart. And Alcoholics Anonymous has healed my heart to the point of where it overflows. I am pleased to tell you that I like who I am today. I am pleased to tell you that there is no one in my life that is my enemy of my doing. I'm pleased to tell you that there are no amends to make that I know I need to make. But most of all, I'm pleased to tell you that I'm with you. There is no place else on earth I'd rather be tonight than right here. Because my God is in the present moment of now. And I want to thank you for having me. I want to remind you that probably Cersei and Bob would say, enjoy sobriety. We've got the best answer here in the world, but let's do it with enthusiasm, and let's have a few laughs along the way. God bless you.